It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Earlier this month, Washington and Jefferson College President Dr. Tori Herring Smith announced her retirement from the college effective June 30th, 2017. 11 years ago, she made local history when she became the first woman president of Washington and Jefferson. Dr. Herring Smith joins us now for the latest installment in our series of what we call exit interviews. Tori Herring Smith, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you so much, Paul. It's a pleasure to be here.
What was it like to be the first woman president of Washington and Jefferson College? As you walked in the door, were there certain challenges that were in front of you because of that? What was it like?
Early on, I used to always say, I wonder how long it will be before I am not introduced as the new president and when I am not introduced as the first woman president. And it took many years to get beyond both of those particular monikers. I would say the greater surprise was taking over the role of the presidency. I don't wake up in the morning and say, you know, I am woman, hear me roar. And I don't think that I see a lot through that gender lens. So it was more getting used to the older alumni. You know, W&J only had male students until 1970. So we've just been co-ed since that date. And for the older students who graduated before 1970, it was almost inconceivable that they would have a female president. They had no female students. How could they ever have a female president? So it was more working with them to get them to understand how their college had changed and evolved.
And there were probably a lot of colleges that and universities that at some point not too terribly long ago, weren't able to envision the idea of a woman president. So what do you suppose it took to break that glass ceiling finally?
Well, I think a number of colleges are now bringing in women presidents. I mean, the Ivy League group is predominantly women now, which is, again, it's hard to imagine. So I think it's the number of females who are coming up through the ranks, through the pipeline, if you will, as academic leaders, as business leaders. I had been a teacher for 35 years. I'd run a foundation. I'd been abroad and been the artistic director of an English language theater in Cairo. I had the kind of background, I think, that made me a good contender for presidency. They were down to two finalists, and I happen to know that the other one was male, so I consider myself very lucky to have been chosen, and we'll see who the next person is.
How would you say that the college has grown since you came in January of 2005?
Well, it's grown in numbers. That's certainly true. It's grown in diversity. In other words, it reflects the changing demographics of our country. But more importantly, I think it has grown in its internationalization. It was very important to me, as I said when I came, to bring W&J into the world and the world into W&J. We had just a handful of international students, and now we have more than 100. And that sense that the world has come to W&J, that our students can talk with students from Nigeria, from South Africa, from Ecuador, from Japan, from Burma. That's a wonderful opportunity for them to learn about the world. And then similarly, in terms of diversity, we've always had a wide diversity of political and ideological opinions, which is not widely recognized because you can't take a photograph of it. We've preserved that diversity of political and ideological points of view, but at the same time, we've increased the visible diversity, the diversity of race and ethnicity, so that now about a quarter of our students are students of color.
So you're saying that there isn't a political ideology, that it's neither conservative nor liberal. It just is a mix.
That's right, and that's amazingly rare, actually, in a college. If you think of a large university, you have a broad diversity of opinion, but students who tend to agree with one another will clump together. They'll live together off campus or whatever. If you look at a small liberal arts college, some have in their very mission a homogeneity of opinion. So someplace like Grove City, for example, that is its mission, to have students with a particular point of view. Others just naturally come by it, whether it's liberal or conservative. I always say I taught at Brown for almost 20 years, and everybody there was very liberal. It was very comfortable because everybody agreed with everybody else and nobody ever challenged them.
And at the end of the day, is that a good thing for the students?
No. We all knew we were right, you know. And as a teacher, I had to say to the students over, I had to challenge them. And I'd say, but somebody might disagree with you. Oh, well, then they would be wrong. No, they might actually have a point of view. What I love about W&J is the fact that we have this broad spectrum of political and ideological points of view. I always say college is a conversation. And I really want to foster the capability of students to work with others who share their passion for environmental issues or pro-choice or whatever it may be, but also to sit down in the cafeteria with someone who holds a different point of view. Challenge them, learn from them, listen to them, and so begin to develop the skills we need to build a strong democracy.
That's why you have the college Republicans and the college Democrats.
And in the civics house, they're roommates.
Right. There you go. So that would another way of enriching the experience. You say WNJ has a wide socioeconomic swath. What mm-hmm. does it encompass, and why is it important?
Well, I think it's more enrichment of the student experience. Students have the opportunity, whatever socioeconomic stratum they may come from, to talk with individuals who have been privileged enough to travel around the world multiple times, live in gated communities, have the privilege of visiting museums and knowing leaders. And at the same time, they have the privilege of knowing someone who has scrabbled for a life, whose family may have virtually no resources, who may have been relatively isolated, to look at their different points of view, to listen to them on issues of welfare and taxes, and how should we be building a country that is more unified. So having students who are, we have some homeless students. Having students from that end of the spectrum through the middle class up to individuals one would classify as upper class, that broad spectrum enriches the educational experience of our students in what I think are important ways.
And you may have a student who is from an upper class family rooming with a student who is, as you say, I wasn't aware that there were actually homeless students at WNJ or at any college. So, if they are in a living situation together, that must be an interesting experience for both of those students.
It's fascinating. One of my favorite roommate pairs was actually demonstrated that. One of them was from Los Angeles and extremely privileged. Another was from West Virginia and had not traveled. In fact, thought that when she got to Washington, she'd really hit the big city. It was kind of terrifying.
Wow.
And the two of them were roommates at freshman year. And the one from Los Angeles said, "You must come home with me to Los Angeles." But they weren't quite ready to do that. So the one from West Virginia said, "No, you come home with me." So this very privileged kid went to a farm in West Virginia. When they came back, they emailed me. I'm very close to the students. And they said, "We have to have lunch." And I thought, oh, this is going to be bad. And instead, I said, "What happened?" And Dina, the girl from Los Angeles, said, "You wouldn't believe what I learned. I'd never seen a cow." And the next year, they went to L.A. because Dina's family paid for the girl to go to L.A. and came back. And she said, "You wouldn't believe what I learned." Two girls remained roommates for all 4 years.
That is a great story.
And it's typical. As I said, we have a dormitory where students voluntarily room together because they differ about important social or political issues. So the head of the college Dems and the head of the college Republicans have been roommates. And it's an important building block for democracy. I really think that.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and my guest is Dr. Torrey Herring-Smith, who is the president of Washington and Jefferson College, the first woman president. I promise I won't keep saying that, but it does bear repeating to a point. She is announcing her retirement from the college effective June 30th, 2017. You're giving yourself a lot of lead time there. Any particular reason for that?
Well, it generally does take
is that how it works?
A year and a half or so in the academic world to find a college president. In fact, I thought I might be a little late in announcing
really?
It. Other presidents retiring on that same date were announcing in February and March. And I thought, oh, I may be late. But I've been working with the board for about 9 months preparing for this announcement.
And so you have identified this date at which you will depart, but in the meantime, there are still things that you're overseeing, including a very interesting project called the Magellan Project, something you fostered. What can mm-hmm. you tell us about this?
Well, the Magellan Program is specific to WNJ, and it is designed to allow any student, regardless of their family's level of wealth, any student to go abroad on an independent research project or internship that may be career-related or study-related or may not be during the summer, so that even athletes who have seasons that span both semesters, any student can make a proposal to go work with a faculty member, create the contacts they need, develop their budget, and then we will fund them to do that project. So you can be wealthy or you can be poor, and you can go off. This summer, we were sending 73 students. One will go to work in an elephant sanctuary in Cambodia, and she wants to be a veterinarian. So it'll be an amazing way for her to make her application stand out among all the other students applying to veterinary school with good grades and good reputations and good recommendations and all of that. We've got kids going to work with orphans in Bolivia, somebody looking at poverty in Australia, somebody who went to a Burmese monastery and lived there studying how religious attitudes shape attitudes toward the environment. People go and study ecotourism and that's effect on the environment in the Galapagos or the Great Barrier Reef. Two people are going to Europe this summer to look at the migrant crisis and how that's being dealt with. So it's people, and some are domestic. About 10% of the Magellans are domestic. So some people use it for, we have somebody doing medical research at Johns Hopkins, that sort of work in the country.
How does the college pay for this?
We pay for it with individual gifts from alumni who feel this is important, that it builds student self-confidence, global citizenry, all the things that we say we want our graduates to have. And I got to say, when the students come back, they're totally changed. The program will be 10 years old next year. We will have given close to 500 students this opportunity in 10 years. And next year, we will spend our $1 millionth dollar toward it. It's the sort of thing that a small college prides itself on. We want our students to be free in the world. We want them to be comfortable in the world. We want them to understand and not have a fear of the rest of the world. Because whatever they do, whether they're doctors or lawyers or teachers or social workers, whatever they do, it's going to be global.
What does America need to do to make college affordable for all who qualify?
And there's
an ongoing debate about this, as you well know.
You wanted to ask me easy questions, didn't you, Paul? Well, if I were king, what would I do? We're looking at how to make college affordable. I'm trying to think where to start answering that question. If I were president, I certainly would not begin with free college because, quite frankly, that will benefit those who can afford college more than those who cannot.
How is that?
Well, those who can afford college will suddenly not have to pay for it, right? So you will have no money coming into the system from those who could afford it. Those who can't afford it not only cannot afford college, but even to go to college free, they have to keep working. They have to keep working to feed themselves, to house themselves, to help their family, whether it's siblings or parents or whatever. So those who are really strapped will still have those pressures. So I don't think that's the solution at all, besides which I have no idea how anyone would ever pay for it. I think what we have to do is to go back to the notion of common good. When we developed the notion in the early 20th century that everyone should go to high school and high school should be free, we did it with the notion that it would be for the common good, that all our children and the entire community needed this. We've lost that. And now we want something just for kids like us. And I think we have to get back to that notion of common good and commit to it as a country, so that we get better state funding, better federal funding. We have the commitment of the corporate world as well as the foundation world. And individuals who give back to their schools, we're blessed at WNJ. I've been able to raise about $150 million for the school in 10 years because our alumni trust us to spend our resources well. And they know that they walked through the halls of buildings that people before them gave money to build, and that they were taught by faculty who alumni before them gave gifts, and therefore we have professorships to hire those faculty. If everybody thinks in that way and pays it forward, if you will, I think we'd have a better system.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and my guest is Washington and Jefferson College President Dr. Tori Herring Smith, the first woman president of WNJ. She is retiring from the college. She's announced her retirement. It's effective June 30th, 2017. So what are the key challenges facing colleges like Washington and Jefferson, and how well positioned is your school to handle those challenges?
We're really very blessed, actually, at WNJ. I think the challenges are, right now, being able not to convince the public of the value of education, but rather to demonstrate it. And to demonstrate that the value of education, yes, is a job. It's not necessarily your first job, My husband and I graduated from one of the top colleges in the country. My first job was to be a retail sales girl. His first job was mowing the grass in the town cemeteries. I'm now a college president. He's a nationally known IT consultant. So it's not your first job. And our kids now think it must be the first job. Hmm. Nor is it simply your job. It's also learning the skills of citizenship. Being able to determine who is the appropriate person to vote for. Being able to be an active citizen in your community. Understanding culture. Appreciating what people from other cultures may bring into your neighborhood. Understanding how to build a neighborhood organization. How to parent well. What ethics is. Those are the kinds of questions that we need to address as well. So leading a full life as well as leading a life with a really good job. W&J is really well positioned. Last year's class graduated in 2015. 93% of them had jobs or had been admitted to graduate school, med school, whatever, within 6 months.
Where are they finding their jobs?
Well, everywhere. In about 40% stay roughly in this region. Others have gone as far away as Germany and Japan. They're working in industry, they're working in tech, they're working in medical. We're number one in the country per capita for producing future attorneys, which is something I always apologize for. but I think that when I reach the pearly gates, we're number three in the country per capita for producing future doctors. So I hope that whoever stands at the pearly gates says, your doctors healed the stress caused by your attorneys and you can come in. So,
and I'm sure there's some good lawyers in that batch too.
There are. You can't shake a stick in Pittsburgh without hitting a W&J educated lawyer or physician.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and my guest is Washington and Jefferson College President Dr. Tori Herring Smith, the first woman president of W&J. She is retiring from the college. She's announced her retirement. It's effective June 30th, 2017. Here in Pittsburgh, we have been observing Remake Learning Days, Remake Learning events, and as education experts reassess how we learn and how we teach. What are the things that you think we should be focusing on?
I think the most important thing is to look at the current generation as in terms of not what do they not do that we can do. In other words, we'll say, well, they don't have a long attention span, or they don't have this, or they don't have that.
But is that true, by the way?
Yes. Actually, the attention span of those students coming into college in the next 5 years is, I saw the statistic the other day, 8 seconds. That's their attention span.
Wow.
And we've got two responses to that, right? We can either say, well, that's horrible. Or we can say, all right. When I, as a 63-year-old, approach a problem, nobody better interrupt me. I need uninterrupted time. That's an advantage, but it's also a deficit. Whereas somebody with an 8-second attention span can do 8 seconds here, 8 seconds there, 8 seconds here, and then back to the first, and then on to the second. And somehow they can string all that together. It's an entirely different skill. It's not a lesser quality skill. It's a different skill. And if we recognize that as a different skill, then how do we teach to them? I like to talk about it as two cultures. So if you went abroad and you saw people were not wearing Western clothing, you wouldn't say that was something bad they were doing. It's something culturally different. It probably advantages them in terms of their weather and everything else.
I guess we wouldn't say it was bad unless it was bad.
Right.
So what you're saying is the 8-second attention span, the shorter attention span, is not necessarily a bad thing. It's just a different thing.
It's a different thing. And yes, they do have to learn how to extend that. Just as somebody, a Luddite like myself, has to learn to work in a faster way when I'm on the internet. I have to learn to grab information quickly. So, yes, we have to teach them in the course of what the transformation we have to achieve in college is to take them from a short attention span to a longer attention span, to teach them what they now call is grit, that is the ability to persevere. And I think W&J is really fortunate in that our students are earnest. And they have a lot of grit. A third of them are the first in their families to go to college. Two-thirds of them are, you know, from upper class and very well-off families. But one-third have really struggled.
What do you suppose it is about W&J that attracts those students?
I think it's the small classes, close interactions with faculty. So the really privileged students and the very academically talented students know they're going to be able to work closely with a faculty and do academic research that's going to drive them to the kind of success we see with our graduates. And those who are a little more fearful, I was one of those. I'm a third generation college professor, but I went to a public high school in the middle of Illinois in which of the 400 people I graduated with, only four of us went on to college.
Wow.
I went out to Swarthmore. If I had not had the relationship I had with an English professor there, I would have dropped out because I wasn't prepared. And so if you're really prepared and very talented, you're coming out of the top high schools in this country, you're going to WNJ, to a place that will offer you the opportunity to do research and Magellan's starting as a freshman. If you're coming out of a less blessed, less privileged high school, maybe smaller, maybe more rural, maybe just not having the same sort of tax base, you're coming to a place where somebody's going to say, you can do it. And faculty who are dedicated and would sit down with you and say, we're going to bridge this gap. And by the time you leave, by the time the students graduate, I can't tell what high school they came from, whether it was a strong or weak high school. I can't tell what their socioeconomic background was. They have all become intellectually curious, successful, focused students who are succeeding. It's really exciting to watch.
There was one more thing I wanted to ask you about before we wrap this up, and that is the 16 years that you spent teaching theater and writing at Brown University. You mentioned this earlier in our conversation. How important is it to make sure that the arts remain an integral part of higher ed, and for that matter, high school, because it may be a lot more difficult for someone to find their way successfully in an arts program in college if they haven't had a chance to engage in it in high school.
I think arts programs in high school are absolutely essential. The arts teach you to see the world in a different way. They teach empathy, whether you're reading a novel or acting in a play. They allow individuals who can express themselves with visual images and with soundscapes to be able to express emotions that can't be expressed in equations. I started life as a math major. I have the greatest respect for math. I married a math major, so I have no disrespect for the sciences whatsoever. But without the arts, we've lost our humanity. Our humanity is inherent in our ability to express who we are, whether we do it with music or whether we do it by telling our stories to one another in a community theater experience, writing books. I think without the arts, we lose our soul.
And how are the arts doing at WNJ?
Really well. I'm so pleased. Our jazz ensemble is led by an international award-winning composer who looks like he's 12 years old, but the kids love him. And if I had a CD to play of the jazz ensemble, you'd think you were listening to a professional group. Our choral director is also the choral director for the Mendelssohn Choir here in Pittsburgh, and she's now the president of the Choral Directors Association for the entire state. Our theater department just put on an amazing locally written play about cross-racial and cross-religious differences in college populations that was incredibly powerful. So things are going, and our art students go on to some of the top art schools in the country. So I'm very proud. Some of our art students go on to be doctors, but they go on to be better doctors because they're also artists. I use the example of Steve Jobs, and you know Steve Jobs mm-hmm. was such a successful person because he was not only did he have business acumen and technical acumen, but he also studied calligraphy. So he stopped the run of the first group of Macs because he said they're just too ugly. We can't send them out. And those features of an iPhone or an iPad, those rounded corners, the particular kind of glass, those were all things he insisted on from an artistic perspective. And I always say to the students, that's a liberal arts education, that you can be a businessman, a technician, and an artist.
You mentioned writing books in our discussion. I understand book writing is part of your retirement plans. Mm-hmm. Tell us more about what you plan to be doing and writing about.
Well, I'm very excited to get back to I've loved my 12 years at WNJ. It's been an incredible honor. But I really want to get back to some research and writing. And my first project is going to be The Mothers of Pearl Harbor. We know the story of the Battle of Pearl Harbor. It's been told infinite times. But we haven't really heard about the mothers. the mothers who had to go to Pearl Harbor, my father was a Pearl Harbor vet, so I'm associated with this. And my grandmother had to go to Pearl Harbor and convince the Navy to release him. He had what we would now call PTSD, severe PTSD. And they wouldn't release him. So my 4'2" grandmother had to go from Cambridge, Massachusetts in a train across the U.S., then in a boat out to Hawaii, convince the Navy admirals to, as she said, give me back my boy. Then get on a boat with grievously wounded soldiers, wounded physically and mentally, all the way back, soldiers dying on the boat as they made it way back to the mainland, and then she made her way back to Cambridge. So I'm focusing on a number of women. I'm focusing on her, a woman who was told her son was killed, and 2 years later, he showed up on her doorstep. A Japanese woman whose son was on a boat in Pearl Harbor, and she was living on the island of Hawaii at the time. What was her journey like? So looking at the mothers and how did they respond to this important moment in American history.
And how will you gather those stories? Because obviously we barely have any of the survivors of Pearl Harbor left with us. So certainly their mothers are not around. So what do you have to go? I'm very curious about how you'll research this or where you'll get your material from.
It's not going to be easy, but there's some at the U.S. Archives. There's some in the Pearl Harbor survivors' papers. And what I'm looking for are the grandchildren who will still have those stories. And then I can trace them back, in some cases, through newspapers. I mean, sometimes that's as simple. Looking for diaries, I can use the survivors list and the veterans who were killed list, the casualties list, to be able to trace back families and ask about the family stories, see if there are notebooks. You know, that generation was scrapbookers, and they were diary keepers. We blog, they diaried. And that's what I'm looking at.
It makes you wonder years from now when, you know, somebody else is researching a book on a fascinating topic, where are they going to read? You know, are the blogs going to still be there, or, you know, is it going to be on some server somewhere else in an underground?
Yeah, you talk about losing our arts. I worry, are we going to lose our history? Precisely that. In fact, as I prepare to leave, I realize all my records are electronic. You know, the contracts I wrote people, the negotiations. Do I print all that out and leave it for my successor? How do I sort through that for him or her? And as I do that, I realize the history of the college is at stake. Actually, one of the things I'm doing, my very first writing project, which I'm in the midst of right now, is completing a history of W&J. Which has never really been written before. And I want to do it in a friendly way. I want to do it in a narrative way, fully researched, but, you know, so that you can tell the thread, the arc of the story through. And it's a fascinating, since we're the 11th oldest college, it's a story of America as well.
Absolutely. Well, certainly you will look forward to writing your books. We'll look forward to reading them. And I will say thank you for being with us and being so generous with your time. As we have conducted this exit interview, my guest has been Washington and Jefferson College President Dr. Tori Herring Smith, who is retiring after 11 years. Her retirement becomes effective June 30th, 2017. We're glad you're going to be around for a while. And again, thank you so much for being with us on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you, Paul. It's been an honor.
More Essential Pittsburgh coming up. This is 90.5 WESA.